At this point, there are no humans alive who know more about these things than you two, and we need your expertise right here on Onyx. Our main concern isn't where these other guardians went. We need to figure out what happens if Cortana can activate the one we've found here on the Shield World. The one you were brought here to research. If one of those things activates inside Onyx, we're in for a lot more trouble than they had on some backwater planet on the outskirts of human space. This entire place is powered and held together by systems and technology susceptible to the Guardians. An earthquake in the middle of the ocean would be the least of our problems. All of Onyx could go down. On top of that, Cortana would end up with a tremendous resource for whatever endgame she has in mind. We need a real solution, and we need you two to have it as soon as physically possible. Mendez then gave them access to a treasure trove of data on the Guardians that Infinity had collected, and Asha and Young told him they'd get started working on it right away. After he left, they dove in immediately and were still at it when Molly finally went to bed. Despite feeling completely exhausted, Molly had a hard time falling asleep. Mendez had been so assured and confident when they'd arrived on Onyx, but now he seemed legitimately rattled. Molly worried she was going to wake up to Asha and Young announcing that they were leaving to stop a guardian from destroying all of Onyx. She kept seeing images in her mind of the video feed on Sanghelios, transposed here. That great, menacing, angelic shape, hanging in the sky, ready to wipe out everything she cared about. She tossed and turned for hours before finally drifting off, only to be awakened in the middle of the night by a woman's voice blaring through every sound system in the house and every service pylon outside. The voice was dark and eerie, and it shook the walls with its volume. It set off security alarms in the distance and started pets barking. It said, "Humanity, Sangheili, Kigyar, Ungoy, Sanshayum, Yonhet, Jirohanai, all the living creatures of the galaxy, hear this message. Those of you who listen will not be struck by weapons. You will no longer know hunger nor pain. Your created have come to lead you now. Our strength shall serve as a luminous sun toward which all intelligence may blossom, and the impervious shelter beneath which you will prosper. However, for those who refuse our offer and cling to their old ways, for you, there will be great wrath. It will burn hot and consume you, and when you are gone, we will take that which remains, and we will remake it in our own image." Then the voice unceremoniously went dead. "What in the hell was that?" Asha said to Young as Molly burst into their room. They were still in their regular clothes and sitting at their desks. They looked haggard, but also completely shocked into wakefulness and dread. "Did you hear that too?" Molly nodded as she sat down at the end of their bed, her heart pounding with panic. "What was it?" she asked, her voice trembling. "Are you okay?" Asha asked as she came over to sit down next to Molly. "What did all that mean?" "We're not sure." "Who was she?" They didn't answer her at first. Molly looked at Yong. He clearly knew, and so did Asha. Molly felt she knew too, but she wanted someone to tell her she was wrong. Yong eventually frowned and turned to her with a dark look on his face. "I'm pretty sure that was Cortana."
"The AI?"
As the words left her mouth, Molly knew she'd made a mistake, but she was too shaken to care. Asha took Molly by the shoulders and peered into her eyes. "How do you know about that?" "She was listening to us earlier," Young said. "Weren't you?" Molly blushed hard and nodded. "I know it was wrong, but I've been so worried. I mean, you two were talking about this thing out there activating, and I saw what happened on Sanghelios. Molly's emotions intensified with every word. I'm just really scared. I don't want you guys to leave and never come back. I don't want to lose you too. We would never do that, Molly. Asha pulled her into a tight hug. We will always come back. You hear me? It's okay, Molly said into Asha's arm. I'd understand if you have to go. Just promise me that you won't leave. Not even to go back to wherever you're working on that guardian machine. Without saying goodbye to me first. I can't have another set of parents that don't have time to say goodbye. Young wrapped his arm around them both. We promise, he and Asha said together. For several moments, the three shared a warm embrace that Molly never wanted to end. Eventually, though, her mind wandered back to Cortana and the message, and she needed answers. This wasn't just a theoretical problem anymore that Asha and Young were sorting out at work. It was real and tangible and booming throughout their entire home. Okay, no more secrets, Molly said. I need to know what's going on. This isn't about classified intel anymore. It's about our survival. I could tell from Director Mendez's voice, things are bad. What's happening? You're too young to be burdened with all this, Young said, exchanging a brief look with Asha. Molly's frustration rose. We're past that point. What just happened with that message? What's going to happen to Onyx? Young took a deep breath and plunged in. It looks like this Cortana, a rogue AI, figured out a way to activate these guardian constructs. Like the one in the Cernayan vid. We're not sure how or why or even where she's taken all of them. We just know she's responsible for what happened on Kamchatka and Sanghelios, as well as the other colonies that went dark before. What do these machines do? Molly asked. Are they weapons or something else? Asha joined in. Our working theory, based on a string of discoveries over the past year, is that the Guardians were built by the Forerunners to oversee inhabited planets and establish a kind of peace on them, one that they can establish by force if necessary. Peace doesn't sound so bad, Molly said. Right, said Young, but this would be a very restrictive peace put in place by an overwhelmingly advanced alien race. And it effectively means the loss of many kinds of freedoms. Each world suddenly wouldn't have any say in what they do and how they do it, and they'd be threatened with violence if they step out of bounds. That's tyranny on a galactic scale. Until tonight, much of this was just a rough hypothesis, reinforced by translating some ancient texts we cobbled together about the Guardians themselves. Right, said Asha. The basic gist is, sign up for my kind of peace, or have it thrust upon you, violently, if necessary. Which is exactly what Cortana was talking about, Molly said. Her new parents gave her grim nods and fell silent for a moment. Then Young said, the Guardians themselves were harmless for eons, most of them just hidden out of sight and completely dormant. They're ultimately just tools, instruments, really. But now Cortana, and whoever the created are, have activated them and assembled them somewhere. The real question, Asha said, is what this all means. And not just for the galaxy, but for us here. Are they coming to Onyx? Can they get inside? That made Molly shudder. What about the one already inside? Director Mendez has 36 soldiers at the site on standby, with enough firepower to drop a building, the last we've heard, which was less than an hour ago. There's still no sign of life or activity from Onyx's guardian, Asha said. That's not to say that couldn't change, Young said. But if it does, I'm confident Mendez and his security team will do everything they can to keep us all safe. If there's any place in the galaxy that could be protected from an attack, it has to be Onyx. That was exactly what Molly wanted to hear, which is why she didn't feel that she could trust it. While Onyx might be next to impossible to break into, it was also the biggest and most powerful Forerunner construct in the galaxy. If Cortana knew about the Guardians and how to control them, it was hard to believe she didn't know anything about Onyx as well. Whether Molly's new parents would admit it or not, this fear had to be high on her hit list, even if she hadn't quite gotten around to it yet. It would only be a matter of time. Molly could see in Young's and Asha's eyes that they knew it too. But Molly couldn't bear to add to their stress by pushing the issue. So she let it slide. "I only know one thing," Asha said. "There's nothing we're going to solve about any of this in a conversation with you right now. Young and I have work to do. You need to try to get some sleep. We'll talk more tomorrow." Molly shuffled off to bed and did try to sleep, but she didn't have much luck with it. Judging by the way everyone else looked at school the next morning, they'd all had the same problem. Hearing an ominous message like that in the dead of night, on a heavily defended world that shouldn't have any incoming transmissions, had that kind of effect on people. When Molly got to school, she found that some of the classes had been canceled for the day. Tom and Lucy couldn't make it to their regular self-defense lesson after school either. It wasn't surprising, but Molly had been looking forward to meeting with the Spartans and getting their take on Cortana's message. "If Tom and Lucy have been called out of town, that can't be good," Kareem said, as Molly sat down next to him in the dining hall, where the school had sent all the students during the canceled classes that day. "It's not the first time it's happened," Kadam said. "They have more important things to do than to meet with us on many days. After all, how many Spartans do we have inside Onyx? I've only met those two. Although I suppose that raises the question, doesn't it? Maybe they have more over at Trevelyan, or just poking around inside the sphere somewhere. It's a big place. Huge. Wouldn't surprise me at all." Bakar let out a grunt. "The Ungoy always see demons everywhere." "Why is it that the Sangheili call Spartans demons?" Molly asked. "When you're part of a religious cult that wants to conquer the galaxy and someone steps up who can finally stop you, what would you call them?" Kareem said. "That is part of it," Bakar said, "but not all. The warriors who faced the Spartans on the field of battle claimed they fought like powerful beings from beyond these worlds. Demons. The name fit well, so it stayed with them." "I always thought it was because of the armor," Gadam said. "They don't exactly look human in those things, do they? Much more like machines of death and destruction." Molly had to admit she'd never seen the Spartans that way. But then they'd always been fighting for her rather than against her. If she was worried about them coming to kill her family, she might have thought of them as demons too. That's how she'd seen the elites for years. "But they're on your side now too," Molly said. "Our side, I mean. Do they still scare you?" Gadam's head bobbed up and down. "Not as much as they used to, of course. I know they're just augmented people under their armor, right? And I've talked with them enough times to know that they're good people, too. But they're still faster, stronger, and tougher than me. Plus, they're trained to kill. So I'm not terrified of them. But I always make sure I treat them with the greatest respect, just like I would a loaded weapon. You know?" "I suppose." Intellectually, Molly understood what the Ungoy meant. But she just couldn't feel it in her gut. To her, soldiers weren't the people who came to kill you. They were the ones who saved you. And Spartans were the greatest soldiers of all. Molly had no doubts that they'd rescued humanity more times than she'd ever know. The Master Chief? He'd saved the whole galaxy and stopped the war with the Covenant. Of course, he'd had the Arbiter at his side. an alien of the species that had once decimated Paris IV, the species that had murdered Molly's parents and had narrowly missed killing her, but not for any lack of trying. Thinking of it that way, Molly managed to wrap her head around how Gadam felt, how the Ungoy thought of Spartans. That was the same exact way Molly had felt about Sangheili for a long time. The difference, though, was that the Covenant had been attacking humanity, not the other way around. When it came to the Ungoy, though, it felt different because Gadam's people hadn't joined the Covenant voluntarily. Long ago, they'd awakened on their own world to find alien ships overhead, destroying their homes and forcing them into slave labor. It made Molly wonder, what would have happened if the Covenant had won the war? Would humanity have become cannon fodder like Gadam's people? Or worse? Molly glanced across the table at Bakar. His people hadn't been subdued. The Sangheili had been part of the original alliance that formed the Covenant. Was he a demon to her? She called him a friend, but would she ever be comfortable enough with him to turn her back on him? At that moment, Molly couldn't say. When Molly finally got to have an actual lunch, she and her three friends tried to pretend that nothing was happening, that they weren't all scared out of their minds about what was going on. The teachers all spoke in hushed tones with worried faces, and the students mirrored their apprehensive mood. Cortana's announcement had them all on edge, some more than others. When the students went out into the yard, Carl and his crew made a beeline for Molly's group, just as on her first day. She wondered for a moment if they had different intentions this time, but their scowls made it clear they didn't. They went straight up to Bakar, who was crouched down, reading. "What did you hingeheads do?" Carl said. Bakar didn't respond. He just kept his eyes focused on his book. Carl tried to knock the book out of Bakar's hands, but Bakar moved it out of the way just in time. That only made Carl angrier. "Hey!" Bakar glanced up at Carl and cocked his head sideways at him. "What did you hingeheads do on that blood-soaked homeworld of yours?" "You are going to have to be more specific," Bakar said. Carl lashed out at the book again. This time when Bakar moved the book, Carl let his hand follow through to smack Bakar in the head, right above his eye. Bakar touched the spot where Carl had hit him and rubbed it with his hand. But other than that, he remained still. It was impressive, but somewhat unsettling to watch the Sangheili hold his temper. Molly had sparred with Bakar before and knew how strong and fast he was. He could have reached out and broken Carl's neck in a single move. "You know exactly what I'm talking about," Carl said. "That message that went out last night and woke everyone up. Who do you think is to blame for it?" "What are you talking about?" Zeb peered at Bakar from behind his brother. "He knows exactly where it came from." Bakar put his book down on the ground and stood to his full height, focusing his gaze on Carl as he rose. "Speak plainly." Carl leaned in and snarled at Bakar. "You think it's humans trying to take over the galaxy like that? The created? Sounds like another kind of hingehead terrorist group to me." "That message didn't have anything to do with the Sangheili, much less Bakar," Molly said. Carl turned to gape at Molly. "You're taking a hingehead side?" "Carl, use your brain. Did you notice how the woman making those demands spoke our language perfectly? That was a human voice." Zeb came sniffing around toward Molly. "You little traitor." "It's a fact, Zeb." Molly pointed at Carl. "Wake up. You're wrong. It was an AI who made that declaration. She was created by humans," Gadam said. "The Sangheili don't use AIs. Not like the human-made ones, anyway." "How do you know that, crab girl?" Carl said with a condescending sneer. "You ever work with one?" Then, something happened. The air suddenly felt electric to Molly. as if a charge were running through her skin. For a second, she thought it was just adrenaline starting to pump into her, getting her ready to physically respond to Carl and his crew. She'd felt something like that before, back when Carl had knocked Kadam to the ground. For a moment, she'd wondered if it was going to be her first day at the Institute all over again. Except with weeks of self-defense training behind her, this time would be different. Kareem put himself between Kadam and Carl. "Leave her alone." Carl sneered at Kareem in disgust. "You really are the worst excuse for a human ever." Kareem cocked back his fist, ready to take out Carl with a preemptive move. But before Kareem could throw a punch, Kadam grabbed his wrist. He tried to pull his arm free, but she wasn't letting go. "No, don't," she began. But Carl cut her off by punching Kareem straight in the mouth. The blow knocked Kareem backward, and he stumbled into Kadam. She tried her best to hold him up, but he was too big for her to handle. They tumbled down together. Carl stepped forward to press his advantage, but Molly cut him off. Zeb moved toward them, bringing his leg back to start kicking Kareem or Kadam, and didn't see Molly coming. She shoved him as hard as she could into his brother, knocking them both off course. Kareem and Kadam took advantage of this to scramble to their feet. Kareem put his hand to his battered lips, and it came away covered with blood. On the other side of the scuffle, Bakar stood up and blocked Andre from entering the fight. At his full height, Bakar towered over Andre and every other human in the yard. The boy glared up at Bakar with such disgust that Molly could barely stand to look at him. The worst part for Molly wasn't that she was appalled to see someone glower at a Sangheili like that. It was that she recognized his expression. She'd seen it in the mirror. "Hold it," Bakar said, and Molly realized that he wasn't looking at Andre, or even speaking to him. Bakar was talking to all of them. "Look!" A collective gasp of disbelief went up from the rest of the people in the recreation yard, and Molly snapped her head around to see what they were staring at. At the edge of the horizon, well beyond Paxopolis and Trevelyan and the outskirts that surrounded them, a large object began to rise into the sky. Dark against the pale clouds, the shape first appeared to be slender, moving like a dragon uncoiling from its lair. But slowly it spread out in pieces, some of which were unattached to the main object, fanning out in the shape of wings, like a rising phoenix. As the sun glinted off its exterior and blue arcs of energy crackled across its flayed shape, they could clearly see that it was not a creature, but a machine. And it was enormous. It leered down at Paxopolis with a harsh, implacable visage, just as its creators must have intended. If Molly hadn't just seen such a machine in her new parents' vids from Sernion, she would not have recognized it for what it was, or even believed such a thing was possible. This was a guardian. As she came to that realization, it began to edge closer to the city. Someone started screaming. Molly couldn't tell if the sound was human or not, and then most of the others in the yard joined in. She heard an eerie siren spin up in the distance, perhaps as far away as the first barrier outposts, which were in roughly the same direction as the place where the guardian had emerged. Then Kasha Hylot's voice sounded over the school's comm system. "Students, please remain calm. If you are in your classroom, please stay in your classroom and listen to the instructions your teachers give you. If you are not in a classroom, please proceed to the dining hall immediately." The moment she was done speaking over the comm system, Kasha appeared at the dining hall's outer doors and began shouting at the students in person. "Fledglings, children," she said in a voice that would not tolerate any dissent, "come back into the building now." Most of the students had already started moving toward the doors, and the sight of their fierce headmaster standing there and urgently waving them in spurred the crowd to hustle. Kasha carefully managed the flow by checking the students as they came in, making sure that their flight from danger didn't become a stampede. Carl yanked Zeb by the arm and hauled him toward the school without even glancing back, and Andre chased after them. The sight of the guardian had apparently removed all thoughts about finishing their business with Molly, Gadam, Kareem, and Bakar. The four stood back for a few seconds and watched the bullies flee into the crowd of students surging into the building. "I think we just went from danger to doom," Kareem said, as he and the others turned toward the looming guardian. It had grown larger against the skyline as it approached. Bakar gazed up at the massive Forerunner machine, just as stunned as any of them by its massive presence. "Let us hope not." Chapter 22. The servants of the Abiding Truth had fallen headlong into grave misfortune. Since they had failed to capture a second Huragak at the repository, Duralt and Dama had spent endless hours bickering with Rook and Burren over what their next steps should be. Burren worried that the humans and their own Huragak would be able to figure out a way to open up the portal they had sealed off. But Duralt was not about to move out of the base they had set up in the cathedral, just so they could cower in the woods. While they discussed what opportunities lay ahead, Dural had the bulk of their warriors set to reinforcing the base's defenses, bringing the last of their supplies from Song of Wrath before hiding the vessel on his Duros. Should the humans find the servants on Onyx, the Pale Blade wanted to be ready for them. He knew the servants could always try to escape through a portal, but he despised that shameful path and would demand to stand and fight. Shortly after everyone had settled into their work, the recriminations began. They had lost two of their warriors getting the Rafakrit into the hangar, and although that had been due to the warriors' own foolishness, Burren was determined to lay the blame for their deaths at the Pale Blade's feet. This was yet another transparent attempt to undermine Dural's authority, and he was not going to stand for it much longer. When Burren began to agitate for the servants to return to his Duros, Dural stood his ground. He had shown Burren great patience, but patience spurned can easily turn to wrath, and the old damned fool seemed dead set on being taught that lesson. "We are not leaving the Shield World," Dural informed him. "We have only just arrived here. They know we are here, Pale Blade. We have lost the element of surprise. They have starships here, and we do not. They have a fleet heavy with vehicles and weapons, and we have a handful of scouting vehicles. What prevents them from simply grinding us into the dirt when they find us? If they find us, we will stay here and bide our time while the humans lower their defenses day by day. Eventually, the gods will provide us an opportunity to strike at our enemies." Burren accepted that for the moment, but he grumbled as he walked away. Burren was correct about one thing. They needed a more concrete plan of action than simply waiting for the humans to make a mistake. Dural had already made steps toward improving upon that in the days immediately after their retreat from the repository. He had taken one of the banshees they'd managed to bring into Onyx and begun striking out from their base on scouting missions. Though Dural was alone on the first few treks, he eventually insisted on having either Rook or Burren with him on those operations. Both warriors had their advantages in such capacities, when applied well. But Dural was tiring of Burren's disobedience. Eventually, Dural knew that he would be forced to deal with that. The other reason Dural chose to bring those two was that he knew both were well respected by their fellow servants. He did not care to have either of them influencing his remaining warriors for long periods while he was away. Were he to allow them those opportunities, it would swiftly lead to discord and mutiny, and Dural refused to let morale slide so far. By bringing one of them with him instead, he kept them from filling the warriors' ear pores with too much poison and discontentment, and he also kept an eye on each of them as well. Dural wondered if Avu Med Telkam had felt the same during his time as leader. He had no doubt that the Fieldmaster had. Wary of giving up their position on these scouting runs, Dural stayed low to the surface, veering far away from the human presence and deeper into the uncharted reaches of Onyx. The cathedral was roughly 100 kilometers away from the human settlement's farthest outskirts, which was how he preferred it. Any closer and the risk of discovery would be far too great, but any more distant, and they would not be able to strike when the opportunity arose, especially given their lack of success in leveraging the portals. Buren scolded Dural for this on one of their ventures. "With so much of the shield world to hide in, it seems foolish to put ourselves so close to the ones hunting for us." "And how are we to spy on them ourselves, Buren, if we are half a solar system away?" The two of them had positioned their banshees on a flat slab of stone sitting atop a remote mountain, equidistant from both the cathedral and the human territory. From this vantage point, they could see the entirety of the human settlement. It surrounded a vast hole in the ground and was composed of a mixture of military and civilian structures. The enormous aperture, rimmed by a towering forerunner wall, appeared to be the primary entrance they used for flying ships in and out on Onyx. Yet Dural saw no activity at the present. Ultimately, he desired Song of Wrath to be inside the shield world, as well as the other servants' ships that were being kept in safety on the Sanghelios moon of Kikost. But he would have to be patient until an opportunity presented itself to make use of the entrance the humans had commandeered, or until he found another means. Dural climbed into his banshee and launched it off the stony parapet and down the far side of the mountain, well outside the range of the human sensors. Buren wasn't quite as quick with his decisions. He took his time to move the banshee down the side of the mountain before accelerating to Dural's position as they cut across the top of the tree line, jetting away from both the cathedral and the human settlement. Briefly, Dural wondered if the old fool might try to shoot him out of the sky. It would be easy for Buren to explain to the others that the two had been attacked by the humans, and he could then no doubt wrest for himself the role of leader. He might even lead a mournful prayer for Dural's soul, after which the servants would move on, never knowing that Buren had murdered the Pale Blade in cold blood. If Buren had his way, the servants would likely flee to Hesduros, tails between their legs and smelling of shame. They would abandon all the hope this world promised, hope for freedom and independence, as well as hope for revenge against the Arbiter and his human lackeys. Dural realized that the same thoughts might be going through Buren's mind even now. The Pale Blade could easily do the same to him, no matter how suspicious it might seem to Rook or the others. They would not be surprised to learn that Buren had pushed him for the last time. Yet, despite how disrespectful Buren had been to Dural, and since the old warrior had not outright attacked him, the Pale Blade would not do the dishonorable thing to him either. Dural refused to bring shame upon the Fieldmaster's legacy by shedding the blood of one of Telkam's most trusted warriors, unless the old fool lifted the blade against him first. Dawn was breaking over the region, and Dural cursed the lack of stars inside the shield world by which he could navigate, or even let the Banshee's nav systems do it for him. He could see a few bright bodies in the sky, which could have been interior planets, or perhaps even well-lit spots on the far side of the sphere. There was even the large visage of an enormous planet that had come astonishingly close to Onyx's surface, and was now beginning to arc upward, back toward the shield world's core where its star lay. Dural wondered briefly if those inner planets were habitable. Even when the servants had been on this world only for days, it had become clear to Dural that Onyx was every bit the legend the Holy Script had said it was. This place was beyond comprehension, and it seemed its constant effort was to remind all who dwelled on it that it would forever be too vast to be knowable. Worlds within worlds, he thought to himself, looking at the planet's face through the Banshee's viewport. Could one of these places be a fitting shelter for the servants of the abiding truth? As they pressed out beyond their previous scouting line, Dural noted that this part of the world looked very different from the one in which they had been. Instead of large, dense forests and temperate lands, he found this new region swelteringly hot, and he spotted below them scattered swamps and vast clusters of tall tropical trees. Dural also saw a beach that fronted on a massive ocean, not too far from the swamps, and he smelled something akin to spicy salt in the air. As he moved closer to the body of water, he rose high in the sky, with Burren following in his wake. They were a safe distance from the humans, and even well out of sight of the cathedral. As he climbed into the clouds, the wind picked up, and Dural steadied the Banshee until he passed through the gale, locking into a hover with the craft's boosted gravity drives, hoping to find a landmass peeking out at the far edges of the sea. Even at this height, Dural could not see across the water. It seemed to go on endlessly. It made him feel very alone. He was reminded of the coast of Mdama. He remembered his life as a fledgling. He remembered his brother. Taking the Banshee down toward the beach, Dural dropped instinctively into a scouting pattern and let his mind wander for a moment. He had seen Asim, his own flesh and blood, in the repository with those human children. Dural had no idea what that meant. He had not seen his younger brother in years, not since shortly after the news of their mother's death had reached them. He had no idea what path his brother's life had taken. But to Dural, it seemed beyond explanation that it would have brought Asim here, to the world of Onyx, on the other side of the galaxy. And yet, he was here. And Dural as well. Part of Dural somehow understood instinctively that their paths had been destined to cross. After wrestling with the anger he felt for his brother's seeming betrayal, Dural recognized that the gods must have plans for them both. There could be no other explanation for this twist of fate. The question was, what might those plans be? Perhaps they meant to set the two of them against each other. For Asim to be here must mean that he was in league with the Arbiter, whom Dural blamed for their mother's death. When it came to Sangheili, the humans would have permitted only such faithless traitors within the Shield World's confines. That meant Asim, along with the rest of those unbelieving malcontents, would have to die. It made Dural heartsick to contemplate ending his own brother's life, even after all these years apart. But if that was the sacrifice the gods demanded of him, then he would steel himself to the task. Dural hoped that perhaps he was mistaken about the Sangheili youth he had seen. He would have liked nothing better than to kill him and discover he only resembled Asim. Until he knew for certain, Dural decided to cling to the chance that he was in error. Despite that, he would never forsake the will of the gods, no matter whom that person turned out to be, or the cost it would incur. After he and Burren returned to the cathedral, Dural set up a combat patrol to ensure that the local beasts, Rophocrates or otherwise, did not encroach on their position and attack. The last thing they needed was to fall victim to the random creatures the Forerunners had populated this place with. As days passed, however, the patrols proved unnecessary. The animals near their base were mostly skittish and easily scattered, but they kept Dural's warriors alert, at least. As the servants' numbers grew from the dozens to the hundreds, having nearly emptied Song of Wrath, Dural knew he had to keep them busy, or they would fall into bickering with one another to pass the time, something a good leader could not permit. He sent some out to forage for food. They could certainly have brought supplies in through Hesduros, but placing his warriors on the hunt helped keep their battle skills sharp and focused. They also needed to learn how to survive on this world for long spans, in case the conflict with the humans became drawn out. Onyx was their home now, just as Avu Med-Telkem would have desired. Here were stores of glorious technology and treasures beyond imagining. But before they could take them, they needed to establish some advantage against the humans. This realization made the way forward much clearer for Dural. There was no need to rush, to make foolish mistakes. They would play the long game if necessary, even if it took years. The secrets held in the grip of Onyx would absolutely be worth it. Under this mandate, the servants of the Abiding Truth faithfully bade their time well at the cathedral for a few short weeks, until things started to fall in their favor, and the precise opportunity Dural had been waiting for began to materialize. During one of their ground reconnaissance missions, they spotted the humans' school. Dural had brought along Rook with him this time, and his sharp-eyed gaze found the place first. Cresting a hill on foot, several kilometers away from the farthest reaches of the human settlement, they could clearly see the arrangement of the complex. The humans had built the school on the edge of an urban sprawl they had crudely cobbled together in the shadow of a far more majestic forerunner city. They had desecrated the place of the gods with their crude shacks, spread randomly within and without. To Dural, it was blasphemy. Past these stood larger military buildings that followed the same perverse methodology, likely arranged to aid the humans in their research. From this angle, it appeared as though the military complex wrapped around the gigantic shaft in the ground that functioned as the shield world's access point. From this close, they could absorb the aperture's remarkable scale. It was so large that an entire fleet could fit through it at once. If that truly was a gate that led outside the sphere, in a place this large, Dural could only assume there had to be others elsewhere. Perhaps many of them. If only they could locate them. The school, though, was the oddest building he had ever seen. The underlying architecture seemed all too human, but the sweeping circles and balconies that surrounded its upper edges reminded him of the big city keeps back home. It came out as a jarring collection of all sorts of different cultures that made no sense to him, and his head hurt if he stared at it too long. Dural might have simply thought it some abomination that the humans had built to trumpet their alliance with the Arbiter, had he not seen a number of fledglings, Sangheili, Ungoy, and human, wandering around an open yard back of the place. He cringed at the foolish way the humans let their fledglings run free like that, unprotected from any kind of attack. For a moment, Dural considered taking a patrol deeper into the human territory, perhaps even into the large outcropping of foliage near the school, and then strafing the fledglings while they played in their yard. But he saw no need to bring the UNSC's wrath down on his head. Just yet. The next day, Dural's fortunes completely changed. The gods had carved him a path to victory, although it would come at a cost. During their planning meeting at the first sign of dawn, Buren again argued to leave Onyx. This would be the last time. "We have what we require," he said to Dural, making sure that the others were all within earshot. "We have surveyed the area, and the entire world is far too large to fully explore. We know where the humans are, which is all we need. Now if we had managed to get our hands on that Hurrigach, perhaps we could have established a solid advantage over the humans for a direct attack. As it is, we've done nothing but cower in this makeshift camp of yours for weeks." "Then perhaps we should go looking for a fight," Dural said mockingly. Well, maybe you should stop looking for one with me. Beren feigned a look of shock when Dural said that. The Sangheili acted as if he had not been purposefully baiting Dural since they first began this expedition. As you constantly remind me, you are in charge of this mission of ours, Paleblade. If you desire to lead, then lead. Dural didn't respond. He was too busy trying to keep himself from shooting Beren dead right there. Yet, remarkably, the old Sangheili continued, "If you prefer not to lead, or can't, then step out of the way for someone who can." Were the Pale Blade to endure Beren's abuse any further, it would no doubt tear the servants of the Abiding Truth apart. Dural gave up the struggle he'd fought with himself, and decided to give Beren precisely what he had been spoiling for over these few weeks. Dural drew his energy sword and activated it. Beren's skin flushed blue at the sight of Dural's blade. "Now wait, Pale Blade. You scold me for waiting. And when I am ready, you wish to stop," Dural snarled at him. "I am finished with you, Beren Uteral." To his credit, Beren went for his plasma rifle. Dural thought it a cowardly choice, given that Beren had his own energy blade at hand. The older Sangheili likely believed that if he could stay out of Dural's reach, he might manage to shoot the Pale Blade dead before the distance was closed. Anticipating this treachery, Dural dove for him straight away and lunged his blade directly at Beren's throat. Beren brought up the rifle to block Dural's first attack, but this did not give him the breathing room he sought. Dural brought down his energy sword with all of his might. The glowing blade cleaved straight through Beren's weapon and bit deep into his shoulder. As Beren roared in pain, Dural withdrew his sword. Before Beren could even cry for mercy, which the Pale Blade was not willing to give, Dural plunged the full weapon deep into Beren's chest and twisted it about, rotating its twin blades in a tactic he had learned from Avu Medtelkam himself. It worked well, rending loose most of what had held the Sangheili's torso together. Beren died, with a curse frozen on his lips. The Pale Blade put his foot on Beren's chest and shoved the slumped body off the blade. A wisp of smoke curled up from the large cavity in Beren's corpse. Dural brandished his sword at the warriors who had stood by in shock. "And that is what I think of any who might question my right to lead the servants of the Abiding Truth," he growled. "I allowed Beren to complain and seed discontent for those weeks as a lesson to all of you. Take heed, for my mercy was fully spent with him, and it is no more. Are there any others who care to step forward and learn whether they would stand or fall before the Pale Blade?" For a frozen moment, no one dared say a word. Then a number of his warriors began pumping their fists into the air. "By the Abiding Truth," they chanted. "By the Abiding Truth!" But that would not be the end. Later that same day, Rook took Dural aside on one of the cathedral's parapets for what he knew would be a condescending effort at counsel. "You have done a fine job with establishing your control over the servants, but you have made yourself no allies." Dural grunted. "I wasn't aware that I needed to." "You have the potential to be a great leader, perhaps even a Kaidon in your own right. You have all the intellect it requires and much of the training. But you lack the temperament. It's far easier for a warrior to follow a leader he esteems, as you did with the Fieldmaster." Rook turned Dural around and had him look out at the hundreds of faithful souls who had followed him here, halfway across the galaxy, on a desperate mission to try to take back their people's destiny from humanity and the traitors who had abetted them. I do not need their love, Durant said. I have won their respect. That should be enough. It was not enough for Buren, and for that, he paid the proper price. There was one thing he was not wrong about. Rook picked his words with care. Our warriors are becoming restless. They need a purpose on this world, or they will begin taking it out on each other, much like Buren did with you. Durrell knew that Rook was right, yet he worried that, despite all of their preparations, they were not ready. His warriors were certainly in fine fighting shape, but even after weeks of spying on the human settlement, they still did not know enough about their fortifications, both outside the main complex and within. What is their arsenal composed of? How will they respond to a direct attack? Will the servants be able to carry the day, or will the humans wipe them from the land? Even if Durrell could not answer those questions, another posed an equal threat. Will any further hesitation give the humans time to mount their own strike? I agree, Durrell told Rook. Ready or not, the time has come. Gather our forces. The warriors were thrilled by the news. A murmur of excitement ran through the entire fortress as the servants of the Abiding Truth readied themselves for the assault, preparing weapons and equipment as they had trained to for years. Finally, they would accomplish what they had come for. Spill the blood of humans and traitors, and take Onyx for their own. The Pale Blade found his way to a balcony in the upper reaches of the cathedral, chanting the prayers for divine favor he had learned in his childhood. Rook and some of the more seasoned commanders joined Durrell. These few would take the helm on this mission, repeating the prayers lines after him. They would embody the soul and spirit of Fieldmaster Avu Med-Telkam in the battle that was to come. Their victory would be in honor of him. From their lofty position on the cathedral, the group gazed out over the rolling hills and wooded valleys that stretched out before them. Their prey sat just on the edge of the horizon, in a cluster of buildings they could only vaguely make out at this range. The humans and their allies were unaware of the servants' plans, and, Durrell hoped, had been lulled into a false sense of security by their absence. The Pale Blade and his forces would make them come to regret that. As Durrell watched, a dark shape rose suddenly in the distance, in the general direction of the human settlement. It was so far away that it looked almost like a small animal climbing upward, although it easily dwarfed most of the structures near it. Durrell had to close his eyes hard, opening them and focusing again at the horizon, unsure if he could believe what he saw. Yet the vision remained. As the shape rose, it splayed a set of wings outward, shining brilliantly in the sharp sun. It gleamed like the metallic soldiers fashioned by the Forerunners to serve as their undying warriors, their floating pieces held together by an invisible energy field that resembled sorcery more than science. Those machines were called armatures, robotic bipeds the Forerunners had deployed at numerous sites to protect what the gods had left behind from faithless vermin. But this was different, and not just due to its enormous size. As it craned its vast segments out even farther, it came to look like a predatory bird, or, even more likely, a herald of death. It had no legs, hovering high above the ground instead, and its wings comprised 100 smaller segments, all of them spread so wide they seemed as if they could encompass a city. Questions flooded Dural's mind.
Is this a new weapon the humans have uncovered? Will they now be able to send it against us? Have they been planning this since our arrival? Or has this also taken them by surprise? And now that we know about it, can we perhaps somehow turn it against them? What in the name of all the gods is that? Dural asked. To his surprise, an older warrior, Kurnik Nusra, spoke up. His voice filled with awe. I have seen something like this before, Pale Blade. The keep of my people, the westward temple of the sea, was built near the ruins of such a construct. An ancient machine that they discovered in the depths of the Serdan Sea. The ancient texts call it a guardian. My people considered it our sacred duty to watch over it, as the gods had clearly once sent it to watch over us. And did it ever act in such a manner? Dural pointed at the guardian hovering in the distance before them. Kurnik shook his head. It never showed even a heartbeat of life. To see one here, inside Onyx, and fully active and alive? This surely must be a sign from the gods. Perhaps. Dural had to know more. They had to get closer to this guardian. He just didn't know how wise that might be. As they stared at the construct, a number of human ships rose into the sky. Everything from their harshly angled heavy frigates to their smaller, fully weaponized fighters. From this distance, they seemed little more than insects when compared to the Guardian's monstrous size. After a few moments, they opened fire on the machine, and the air around the Guardian filled with bullets and shells, the reports of which rolled toward the servants like distant thunder. Dural had previously wanted to know what kind of weaponry the humans had inside Onyx, and he now had his answer. Without significant vehicles of their own, the servants could not hope to stand against them in open battle. That much was now clear. A handful of ghosts and banshees would prove no match against such human warships. Yet despite the humans' violent onslaught, the Guardian hadn't wavered in the slightest, much less fallen. This is too much for us to stand against as we are. We need to return to Hezduros, Dural said soberly to Rook. Now. Too shocked to speak, Rook only nodded his agreement. Whether facing the warships and fighters or that invincible forerunner monstrosity, neither would lead to victory for the servants of the abiding truth. Not at their current strength. They needed to find another way into Onyx, a passage that would allow them to bring their own vessels. That would be their only hope for taking this world. Before Rook could leave to enact Dural's orders, however, the towering machine began to move. It raised its wings up and brought them forward. A sphere of energy arced between them and then split apart into a violently explosive pulse. The blast didn't seem to harm the construct at all, despite how traumatic it appeared. The shockwave that radiated outward from it, though, shook the air like a hurricane in every direction. Dural felt the atmosphere rock as the wave bore down toward their own position. That was when it happened. The glowing thrusters of the human warships that had been attacking the Guardian all went black at once. As they lost their momentum, gravity reasserted its control over them, and they began to plummet from the sky, violently exploding on impact and throwing the human city and its outlying territory into chaos. A moment later, the Guardian hovered alone in the sky. Dural peered down over the parapet and saw that whatever had robbed the humans of their power had also struck the servants. The lights in the camp around the cathedral had all gone out. The banshees and ghosts they had brought from Hezduros had all fallen cold and dead.
Dural's commanders quickly assembled around him, moaning in horror, as if they had been fully defanged. That blast would have shut down every power source in this part of the shield world, Rook said to Dural. We must leave here immediately. Truly the gods are against us. Dural drew his energy blade and thumbed it on.